This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan. This episode is not my usual interview format. Hope you enjoy. In the last weekend of May, Boston hosted the first Open Data Science Conference. The goal of the conference was to highlight open source contributions to the field of data science. Over 1,000 people from all over the country attended. This podcast is a mix of snippets from talks and interviews with presenters, organizers, and attendees.
It took so long to say these words, but welcome to the Open Data Science Conference, everyone. To state that open source software has had a tremendous impact on the growth of data science. So many companies that range from Fortune 500 to startups that just got launched last week use open source data science tools. So where do we fit in? We wanted to build a conference around the notion that you can achieve a tremendous amount with open source tools.
That was Seamus McGovern, chairman of the conference. More from him later. There was much discussion about what data science is and is not, what makes a data scientist, and what the future of the field is. One of the keynote speakers even went so far as to suggest that some people are calling themselves data scientists because they've done an online course. And another drew the distinction between fact-finding with data and data science, saying that data science requires there to be some original research. We were certainly off to an interesting start. This is Josh Wills of Cloudera answering an audience question on whether he thinks an ideal data scientist is a statistician with very good software engineering skills.
I think we see both statisticians who, in order to complete their dissertation or do some interesting amount of work, learned how to program. And then you have sort of like geniuses like Hadley Wickham and stuff like that who just do amazing stuff and is like, he's a total savant, right? I think you can go the other way too as well. I think you can be a software engineer and be like sort of obviously smart, but not like obviously useful, and get tasked to work on something like a recommendation engine. And in the process of learning about how recommendation engines work, learn enough statistics and learn enough machine learning to become a data scientist. So I think it goes both ways, very much so. Great, thank you. I think with that, I'm about to be, they're going to take me out with a crossbow or something like that. I don't actually know. Thank you, guys.
After his keynote address, I asked Josh to expand on his criteria for what he thinks makes a good data scientist.
A data scientist is someone who is better at statistics than any software engineer and better at software engineering than any statistician. So that is a famous tweet I wrote back in May of 2012. It's been retweeted like 1,014 times or something like that by now, and it's, I think, pretty popular in the grand scheme of things. I have roughly the same level of Twitter credibility as whatever Justin Bieber had for breakfast this morning in the grand scheme of things, right? To kind of unpack that a little bit, a statistician is sort of like not as good at software engineering. There's a lot of statisticians who can program, but there are relatively few statisticians who can say, write libraries of code that make other people more productive, right? They write code in a way that's not just designed for themselves, it's designed for like other people to use. In the same fashion, there are a lot of software engineers who know, what a linear regression is, and they know what a t-test is. But unless you have kind of that training in statistics where you have a background on the context of these models, the assumptions behind them, it's entirely possible for you to like carry out an analysis where you violate some sort of fundamental assumption and basically get like nonsense as a result, right? So like not understanding the, independence of irrelevant alternatives and all these kind of other assumptions in these models is a way to like, just basically do bad data analysis. And I see that a lot from sort of software engineers without that statistics background. So yeah, much like that.
One thing you mentioned was that you don't see a whole lot of source control in use in data science. Now, I'm coming from a software engineering background, and it would be unthinkable not to use source control.
So, yeah, that is totally true. I think the one thing that's sort of pushing more statisticians and more data analysts in that direction is RStudio from the RStudio project, like Hadley Wickham's company and stuff like that. It integrates Git, sort of revision control into the actual data analysis tool itself, which I think is the only way to actually get statisticians to A, be aware of it, and B, like actually use it. They love it once they find out about it. They love moving from the, you know, copy of script V1, V2, V3 thing to proper revision control. It's just a function of making it integrated with the data analysis tools they use and just showing, making it easy for them to use more than anything else.
During his keynote address, Alex Cosmas asked the audience if they think data scientists will face extinction.
Folks who think that we will face extinction by 2025, hold up your phones. Take your phones, hold your phones up. Okay, give it another 25 years. 2050, who thinks we will face extinction? We will have a hard time finding jobs. I see hands, I don't see phones. If you don't pay attention to instructions, you're going to be out of a job. All right, and what about indefinitely? At some point, but we can't pinpoint when, we will pivot, we will change, and we will not be data scientists anymore. Hands? Phones?
Most hands in the audience have gone up now.
So take those phones, put them in your pocket, and now pay attention. So this was the actual result. So what bothers me, I think, is that between those three questions, the majority of the hands in the room went up. At some point, and it could be a century, but at some point we will face extinction. And that's consistent with the results of the Katie Nuggets poll, where only 18 or 19% of the readership felt that we will never face extinction. That hurts my head. We should never be okay with that as a species. Now, granted, this is anonymous, so you're sitting next to your friends and you don't want to prove that we're a little insecure, but there's a reason for this. And I think that there's also a realization that we need to have as a community, and I want to talk about that today.
I caught up with Alex after his talk to ask him what he thinks the next generation of data scientists will look like.
So interestingly, I think we're facing a pivot point now where data scientists have historically, over the last decade, been the data curators and the tool custodians of the world. And I think we have to evolve, as other scientists have, to become a true science community. And that means following scientific method. That means being inquisitive. Scientific inquiry is important, in fact, potentially more important than the skills around data engineering. So I think the next generation of data scientists are going to focus more, by necessity, focus more on the hypothesis generation and the iteration of hypotheses, more so than the bigger, faster, larger algorithmic testing. And one example of that I'd see is in the realm of cognitive modeling, where it's important in every field to have an understanding of the underlying dynamics of the system that we operate in. And one of the areas where we don't have a very strong theory is around individual choice and individual decision making. And I think it is also an area where we are ripe with data, digital breadcrumbs being dropped at unprecedented quantities. I think in general, one of the larger focus areas that the data science community will need to tackle, and it's a personal passion of mine, is around empirically training models that mirror the cognitive decisions that an individual might make, whether it be a consumer, whether it be a physician, whether it be the traveling public. And so that's a personal passion, and Booz Allen is taking a pretty big leap of faith in investing in that next generation.
At the end of the keynotes, I checked in with Seamus McGovern, conference chairman. I asked him how he felt the day was going.
I am absolutely stunned by the turnout. We this is the first ever conference. We're expecting maybe we'll get about 700, 800. We'll get a room for 1,200 people just to be sure. And by God, they all showed up. So we're very, very happy with that.
Everything running smoothly?
No. Like any conference, lots of small things, including me being up half the night. And, you know, we've got a fantastic staff of volunteers helping us out with this, 40 or so people. But for the most part, they just showed up this morning to do their jobs, first time in here. And when you take everything under consideration, they're doing very well. But, you know, all behind the scenes. From the front, it looks like it's going fantastic.
So, yeah, it does. Everything looks relaxed. But are you able to relax a little bit more now that it's underway?
Oh, you better believe it.
The field of open data science doesn't refer to just the tools, but also the vast troves of data that has become accessible for free or near free. Here's Ari Hamalian of Booz Allen Hamilton.
The premise of a lot of the talks at this conference has been how the data universe is growing. And inherently, as the data universe grows, so has this trove of open data that's generated, data that's available to the general public, easily accessible, and free, without any restrictions. One of the areas, a lot of the industry sectors are using this open data, but one of the areas that's newly blossoming and taking advantage of this to bring in a lot of reform and change is in the area of how local governments internationally, abroad, are using this data to help usher in development and international aid. A lot of traditional processes that have been used in bringing in international aid have faced challenges because oftentimes they're very one-directional in terms of how the aid is provided. Rich countries are providing reform prescriptions and transferring resources to poor countries. And also, there's not a lot of transparency as to how impactful those programs have been in those countries. Open data actually provides an excellent opportunity because by using simple techniques like geomapping, which looks at where certain funds are being allocated in what regions of the world and to solve what specific problems, and then looking at what the resultant impact of that has been, just putting that on a simple map makes the message much clearer for individuals that are evaluating these programs to assess how successful that these initiatives have been. And more importantly, taking the conversation to that level involves the local populations, the citizens, and makes them part of the process, which I think is absolutely essential in making sure that a lot of these international aid initiatives are successful and succeed.
What's Booz Allen Hamilton's role in all this?
So we've had, you know, obviously over 100 years of experience in a variety of roles as a consulting firm. More recently, Booz Allen has stood up what is the Strategic Innovation Group and the Next Gen Analytics team within that group, which focuses on data science as a service, providing solutions to some of our clients' toughest challenges. What we bring to the problem here is twofold. One is our experience in dealing with these international customers, understanding the policy challenges that they have, the more kind of economic and infrastructural problems that exist in these countries, but then also bringing to bear our team of data scientists and the capabilities that they bring to the table in solving these problems and in applying sometimes advanced analytics techniques and other times just being able to go out and find what open data needs to be fused together to answer these tough problems and help some of our clients that are U.S. organizations delivering aid to these countries complete their missions.
As you'd expect, many companies are looking at the commercial opportunities that data science opens up. This is a snippet of a talk by Bill Deich looking at marketing around cardio issues in men and women and how to appropriately target women.
Okay, males are 1.6, almost 1.6 times more likely to be a cardio patient. Okay, that's important, but it's also very obvious. Okay, so what you would want, this is when it comes in really, really handy from a predictive modeling standpoint, I expect gender to be a significant predictor in my algorithm. In fact, it better be a significant predictor in my algorithm. If it's not, I got to go see what's wrong with the algorithm. Okay, because that's a pretty decent penetration value. But even that's really obvious. Okay, what's not obvious, there's a couple of things, and this is where the contextual knowledge of the area you work in comes in really, really handy. One of the things we know is that females in general are not marketed to for cardio. Okay? Females are underserved when it comes to cardio. And females' rates of cardio problems is almost the same as males. However, traditionally, historically, cardio has always been marketed to males. So the gold mine, from a marketing standpoint, from a predictive modeling standpoint, the gold mine is, are you marketing to women at all? If so, how are you doing it? Because the reason why that's so important, if you look at the blue bar on the left, okay, almost 70% of this patient base is women. But they're spending all their energy trying to get the males. They know they're going to get the males. They don't even have to advertise and they're still going to get the males. What are they doing to get the females in? What would happen is if they switched their marketing tactics a little bit and went after females and they jacked up that blue bar on the right for females, if you get some over-penetration with the females there, your ROI just on using gender alone to tweak your algorithm is going to go through the roof. But that's the one thing that they never see. So what I do when I debrief is I try and explain that. Okay, we know about the males. You guys are probably doing a great job already. You know, let me see what you're doing. What are you sending to these people? And they give me their 4x6 double-sided glossy postcards, and it's a picture of a guy. You know, kind of like you see, like the Viagra ads, a guy. You know, it's like, the guy's going to have a heart attack. He looks like he's going to have a heart attack. You know, but where's the women in the cardio marketing materials, right? That's what we got to figure out. So the gold mine here is you got to market to women. But that's not obvious when you look at these slides.
In the sponsors area, I stopped to chat with a few companies. Here's Thomas Wiecki of Quintopian on their use of crowdsourced data when choosing funds to invest in.
We're building what we call a crowdsourced hedge fund. And what that means is we realized, or it is actually well known, that to build a successful hedge fund, you have to have many different uncorrelated return streams. So that's really the name of the game. So you have to find really independent ideas and thus independent thinkers. And we think that crowdsourcing is actually a perfect model for that, because we can pool essentially from our community of quants that are distributed worldwide.
Sorry, what's a quant?
Quant is generally someone referred to who works as in the finance domain and does quantitative trading using statistical methods. And we have built this platform at Quantopian around backtesting, so building trading algorithms in the cloud and testing those on historical data. And what is unique is also that we have a very open and friendly community of quants that exchange ideas, something that has not really been all that common in quant finance, which is much more secretive. And basically, we will pool the best ideas from that community and people who want to contribute to a hedge fund and tie those together essentially into this meta algorithm and market that to investors.
So am I right in saying that anyone at all can contribute a model and have it tested by Quantopian?
Yeah, everyone at all. So we really built that platform, which is free, by the way, for all users, to really make getting started in quantitative finance as easy as possible. So you go on the website and you can run your first algorithm without even having to sign up. And we use Python, which is very easy to learn as well. And really the idea is that, and I'm personally actually also a good example, where I started 3 years ago and I have a background more from neuroscience and new sort of statistics and coding. So I applied that skill set to quantitative finance, and it's really interesting to bring together people from all kinds of diverse backgrounds and have those contribute ideas, which leads to a much more diverse set of algorithms.
So then, along with contributing an algorithm and having it tested, can individuals then invest in whatever comes out of the results?
Sorry, say that again?
Can they invest their own money, so along with providing the algorithm?
Right. So there's sort of two ways, or I mean, there's many ways you can use the platform, but also if you don't care about the hedge fund, but you have a strategy that you developed and that you really like, you can connect Quantopian to your brokerage account and then use Quantopian essentially, or the algorithm that is running on Quantopian infrastructure, to forward these transactions to your brokerage account where they get filled, and thus basically have your own quantitative hedge fund sort of running on your own capital.
Does this, I mean, obviously a lot of hedge funds have very, very high fees because they claim that their people are experts. Whereas now you're saying pretty much anyone can write an algorithm and potentially do as well as the hedge funds.
Well, I wouldn't say that everyone can write an algorithm. It's still hard work, actually, and it does require training. But yeah, so certainly, though, one idea is that it's very difficult for these experts, right? And they are experts in a very small segment of the market, right? And they might be really good at that. And However, by pooling this across, we can get experts who are like very good at like this one sector, or maybe someone else in Asia who like knows that corner of the market really well, and just pool across that.
But what do you think of kind of over the past few years? There's been a lot of talk of moving much more towards index funds. Even Warren Buffett came out and said he's going to take 90% of his money and invest it in an S&P 500 index fund and the 10% in short-term bonds, and he'll still get better returns than most hedge funds.
So my understanding, and I might be wrong, of what he said is that actually he is an investor, right, in companies. So I think that advice is more geared to what personal investors is to put their money in index funds, and that's probably a good idea for most of them just because of the fees and all of that. But then there's this whole other side of the market where, like, I don't know, pension funds, and whether that is a good model for them or not, I guess. So, yeah, my understanding was that he didn't really comment on that side of the investment spectrum.
No, fair enough. With regard to the performance of the hedge fund, do you keep comparisons between the outcome of your own investments versus the index or versus other hedge funds? Like, are you doing better than most or are you doing average?
Oh, so currently we haven't started the hedge fund yet. So that okay. We announced that we will build that.
Sorry, I misunderstood.
And, I wasn't being clear on that. And so towards that goal, we actually launched a trading competition where users can submit the algorithm, and every month we will pick a winner. And there's a system in place for that. And for that winner, we will invest $100,000 of our own money into that strategy, which remains private. Like, all intellectual property remains to the algorithm writer, and we don't own anything of other people's property. So we invest $100,000, and the winner gets to keep 100% of the profits.
Next, I spoke with Razi Uzun of Data Robot. He explained to me what the company does.
We are a machine learning company, and we help data scientists of all experience levels, whether they're novices or highly experienced. We help them build very accurate predictive models extremely fast, much faster than they would otherwise be able to do. So it's we automate a whole series of processes in the data modeling process, overall process, and that reduces the time to build a model literally from months down to days.
And then you chose to be part of this conference because it's a good place to exhibit, or this is primarily an open source. Is it to support the community as well?
I feel a very important conference from our perspective for a couple of reasons. The way the DataRobot software itself is built is we use libraries from open source tools such as R and Python and Spark, and we want to continue and build on the open source ecosystem. We want to support the open source ecosystem as well as kind of foster figure out how to move and accelerate the adoption of open source in the enterprise. So it's very much aligned with what DataRobot's overall mission is, what our product is all about.
And lastly, I dropped by Basis Technologies to speak with Heather Phipps.
So we are a leading provider of multilingual text analytics, and we're here because we help other companies process large volumes of unstructured text, especially if that text is in many languages. You know, when you talk about big data, a large portion of it tends to be unstructured text that you need to pull out, you know, key facts.
On your display, there's a lot of examples of pulling out a single name in correct spelling, bad spelling, initials, foreign languages, stuff like that.
So a particular interest in text is often the names of people, places, organizations, and we help you extract those, whether they're in English or other languages represented in other scripts, and, you know, resolve the differences in the ways those names of entities can be represented. Basically resolve those to external knowledge bases so that you can match the way that they're represented in text, you know, to their actual, you know, real world counterparts.
The diverse ways of using data science was apparent throughout the conference. I popped into one presentation where the speaker was talking about a tool for farmers to help determine the general health of their livestock based on how much they walked each day. Earlier in the day, we had heard from Ari Hamalian on fighting corruption with open data, but none topped what Eric Schless was using data for.
Human trafficking is a topic that's been near and dear to my heart in terms of ending for a very long time. I first saw slavery back when I was 12. I went on a family vacation to India, of all places, and we saw a man with a chain around his neck, and he was being paraded through the streets. And since then, it's been a whirlwind. I completed several degrees and am now working in the space. So I work for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, where I get to do this every day.
And then how does open data come into this?
Right, so there is a lot of open data in the specifically sex trafficking part of human trafficking. So this is sex slaves, people that are forced to have sex for money and then are deprived of any of the profits or any of the money that they would get from doing this action. Their pimps usually physically abuse them as well as mentally and pretty much don't allow them to have a family or friends. So it is true slavery in a real sense. There are sites like Backpage, and there are websites equivalent to this, sort of like creepier versions of Craigslist, where people can post advertising ads, and we'll scrape that for instances that we think might be trafficking. Usually we're tying it to some internal data that we have, but open data comes into play, just verifying that prostitution actually did take place, and also trying to understand their network so we can take down the whole thing, rather than just freeing one person, actually freeing like six or seven people. Sometimes we get to even free 30, and that's been in a couple instances.
So it sounds like you've had significant successes that you can point to.
We've had some successes we can point to. A lot of the cases take a long time to prove. Unfortunately, a big problem for us is witness recantation. The women are so badly battered that they feel guilty, that they are betrayed their trafficker, as messed up as that sounds. And so we end up actually having cases stall sometimes for 2 years, but we have had some success. I actually don't know the numbers offhand, but we've had some cases go to trial. We freed some women. Actually, just a couple of weeks ago, I was in my boss's office, and he got a message on his telephone from a girl who had said, you know, thank you so much. I've left, you know, this guy. I won't disclose names, obviously. You know, I know that it was a messed up situation I was in. I'm going back to where I'm from. And I'm going to live a normal life now. And, you know, so this, we do have some success at this level. And
I presume there must be more than just data science. You'd probably have data forensics and other teams
absolutely
involved.
So actually, no. I wear a lot of hats. So I do data science. I do data forensics. And I do back-end things, I do web development. Pretty much the entire stack is me. The district attorney's really never had a developer sort of who does things the way I do before, and so I'm picking up a lot of pieces. We do have some forensic analysts on board, but they don't really program, so I'm writing a lot of tools for people. So actually just last week, I got to open source a tool that I've been working on for a while, which does image forensics, and it looks for hidden messages as well as removes EXIF data from images. So that was a lot of fun, I get to use that at the office, and there's other tools like this that I get to build, so not just in the data science. Obviously, that's a very important piece of it, being able to find, being able to find patterns from this data is extremely useful, and it is my main sort of driver, but I can do a lot of other things.
When you're trying to track down a trafficking network or a person, does it start with you, or does it start with the police coming to you?
There's a number of ways that this happens, right? So there's the National Human Trafficking Hotline. If you search Human Trafficking Hotline, you'll find it, and we get a lot of tips through them. So if it's someone in New York, it'll go to us, and we'll take their case. We'll see if they need help. So you can call in if you are in need right now, and you'll be able to get help. Also, we get a fair amount of domestic violence complaints, because women are so badly beaten, battered, that they'll say their boyfriend beat them because they don't want to say their pimp beat them. If we get that, then we'll follow up. And if there's a element of trafficking, we will take the lead and sort of run the case, assuming that it's at the local level. The state level or federal will probably either hand it off to our friends at the FBI, or we'll collaborate with them on the project.
If you look back through my podcasts, you'll see the theme of privacy comes up quite a bit. I was surprised that few speakers brought this up at a conference. One who did was Michael Gretzky of Refinity. Here's part of his presentation, and then I had a chat with him after his talk.
And we think it's important in the data science community to be able to talk about this issue of privacy, because it's kind of the elephant in the room in many cases in what companies are doing with data, especially consumer data, but also employee data.
Michael went on to explain a little bit about what Refinity does and how easily data can be used to identify a person.
We mine existing data sets that buildings and enterprises generate. Buildings have got all kinds of technologies, usually very siloed, very single-purpose technologies that generate reams and reams of very, very structured data that can be used. And the enterprise itself is generating data around human activity through all kinds of technologies, and we can tap into that if we need to in order to understand what's happening in space. Now, thinking about those, say, large data sets, very dense, diverse data sets, starts to raise an interesting problem. There's a really great paper by some researchers cited here, I won't go through all the names, called Unique in the Crowd, The Privacy Bounds of Human Mobility. What they were able to show is that with, say, a minimum of only four data points on a mobile device in the city, this is all using phone data in a city with a population of 1.5 million people over about 6 months, they were able to show that you could still uniquely identify 95% of the users of those devices as they traverse the city. When you have more data points, you can get even better. If you have fewer, I think with two data points, you can get 50% of the population. This suggests that data about people's presence in space can be highly indicative of who they are, especially when referenced with another data set.
I just grabbed Michael Gretzky after his presentation. He's CEO and co-founder of Refinity and discussed privacy about data in the workplace. You were mentioning that companies are in some way trying to fight having privacy rules enforced on them by government.
Yes, so I've seen some examples where corporations operating through foundations supposedly intent on protecting privacy are insisting that government should have no role to play because government is hopelessly inefficient and unable to effectively regulate the marketplace in a way that works well with industry. And so they're demanding the right to self-regulate through rules that they set in place by mutual agreement. Obviously, beating government with the stick that government sometimes fails isn't the whole story about government. There's a role for government to play in regulating as the arbiter of what's good for everybody, not just what's good for the industry. And I think ultimately, if industry is allowed to regulate itself around the privacy issue, that will come back to bite the companies that do that. And so while we're not looking necessarily for more regulation than is appropriate, we do believe that it's appropriate that government regulate here because this is something that affects customers, employees, and companies. And we don't believe that it can be done outside of a regulatory system managed by government, that companies can't do this successfully themselves, that they will hurt themselves and each other in doing so.
Where would you see the balance between regulation and then freedom for a company to do things at its own whim?
I think that when you think about laws and regulations, they really should be there to create a fair circumstances for everybody to operate and not favor either one extreme or the other. So laws that are overly protective of consumers will probably strangle services that consumers might want. Laws that are overly protective of companies' interest in making money from certain business opportunities will probably result in nefarious impacts on consumers. So the balance has to be found between the company's right to create services and offer those and consumers' and employees' right to protect private information while still getting the benefit of services.
As the last presentations of day one were wrapping up, I spoke with Todd, one of the organizing committee.
So Todd, end of day one, how's the conference going?
Seems like it's going pretty well. We've had good crowds, good speakers. Everybody's been really positive about what they've heard, what they've seen. And it seems to be, from my point of view, having to do operations, seems like it's running pretty smoothly. You know, a couple hiccups. That's going to happen anywhere, but we're doing pretty well.
And then tomorrow, same thing, expecting it to run as smoothly?
Well, tomorrow everybody will be used to what's going on. But tomorrow we have a couple more workshops. We've got another great set of speakers coming in. And we have a ton of stuff in the afternoon, which makes it more complicated for me. But it's more content for people that are showing up at the conference.
At the after party, I spoke with a few attendees to ask them how their day went.
Jeffrey Keeling, you've been at the conference the whole day. What was your motivation for attending, and how has it gone?
My motivation is that I wanted to enter into the field of data science. I've only done a little bit on the side, working with Python and Pandas, and I attended some of the pre-workshops that led up to this conference. So I just kind of wanted to get more of a grounding and conceptually an idea of what's out there and to kind of just learn by example with the people doing the presentations here.
So what were the presentations you attended today?
I attended one by a woman from Spotify, kind of a case study for using metrics to drive decision making. And then I attended one on scraping the web, or the deep web. And that was pretty interesting. Probably my favorite.
That was towards the end of the day?
Yeah, it was towards the end.
Well, are these relevant to your own work?
The web scraping is relevant to kind of a hobbyist stuff I do. And then certainly the Spotify one is relevant to what I like to do professionally at my company. I want to build like a new analytics dashboard and just kind of, I think if we're more daily informed with analytics, that will really help us throughout the day and just with decision making in general. Not that we don't use it already, but just, you know, I'd kind of like to up it up a notch.
All right, so Seamus, end of the day, end of the after party. How did the day go for you?
Today went very well. It certainly exceeded our expectations, and the attendees, nothing but good feedback. The speakers, you know, we had a lot of great names there, and they certainly lived up to their billing, so really, really happy.
And tomorrow, another full day?
Tomorrow, another full day. It is a Sunday on a end of May weekend, but it is going to be raining, so we're hoping to have another packed crowd.
Yeah, because today was a beautiful sunny day.
And they still came, yeah.
Yeah, so a lot tomorrow. Of people. I mean, did you get almost 100% attendance, would you say?
We had 1,100 lanyards, and we ran out, and we had to improvise for another 100, so we somehow got extra. So we ended up having about 1,200 people.
Great. That's a wrap for day one, Open Data Science Conference. Thank you, Seamus.
Thank you.
That's the story of the first Open Data Science Conference. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and my next podcast will be back to the normal interview format. The opening music, as always, was The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the music used throughout the episode was Bit Rio by Poddington Bear from the album Bon Voyage.